my privilege to welcome tonight's speaker. Caretaker comes to us from Fresno, so let's give him a warm Valley Grooves welcome.
How you doing? I'm Caretaker. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic and drug addict. All right. I guess the in thing nowadays is your bona fides, right? I'm from Fresno. My sobriety date is January 29th, 1990. And I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. And I have people that I sponsor. A couple of them are actually here tonight. I don't know. That's the thing everybody seems to do nowadays, so I do it. For the record, I basically have one day of sobriety. That's today. I have 8,590 yesterdays to remind me, to give me strength to know that I don't ever have to drink and use today, no matter what. Let's see, a little bit of my story, what it was like. And I'm not big on drunkologues, you know, what it was like when I drank, the things that I did. You know, it took a consensus of everybody here. You combined, you all drank like I drank, and you all did the things that I did, and you all felt as bad as I felt. For me, I guess part of my story that I like to talk about is knowing that I am an alcoholic and how it started. Back getting sober in the 90s, you know, that was like that neo-hippie era there. You know, so we had lots of things that we talked about that I don't hear much about today. But nature versus nurture was a big thing. Was I born an alcoholic or did I become an alcoholic? And the bottom line doesn't matter. I'm standing here today an alcoholic, so it doesn't matter how I got to be one. But, you know, I do remember there was a, my parents used to watch Hollywood Squares, and there was a question on there that was true or false, you can get drunk on water. And I remember the answer being true, that you could get drunk on water. Now I know more about it than I did then, but the reason that was important was we were flying back to see my sister in Florida. We got on a plane, and I was like 7, 8 years old, and I kept the stewardess running the whole time bringing me water because I was going to get drunk because I was flying, because that's what TV said you do when you fly. No idea what drunk was, never saw anybody drunk, but I knew that's what I wanted to be. My father felt that mowing the lawn would teach, you know, important life lessons. So a little over 8 years old, 8 and a half, so he had me out there mowing the lawn with him. But at the end, when we got done, he'd crack open a beer, and then once or twice a week he'd drink, and that would be one of his drinks. He'd have a beer after mowing the lawn. And so he handed me the can of beer about half empty, and I finished it. And he was absolutely right. I learned 2 important life lessons. I learned that I was allergic to grass. And I learned that that beer solved every problem I had. I felt better. I wasn't scared. I wasn't out of place. That, you know, I didn't feel like I didn't know what was happening, or that somebody knew something that I didn't know. All those feelings that I lived every minute of my life I wasn't drunk, those went away with that beer. And I felt better. I felt okay and happy. And I wanted more. I knew that was the feeling I wanted to have always the rest of my life. And it was several years before I got to, but I have a brother that's 20 years older than I had. He passed away this year. But from the effects of untreated alcoholism. But he moved back to Fresno when I was about 12 or 13 years old. And he was a full-blown alcoholic and drank daily. And so I would get to go over and visit him on the weekends to reconnect with my brother that I didn't know. And I got to drink on the weekends with him. And it wasn't long before that drinking on the weekends wasn't quite enough either, because, you know, I had the whole school week in between, and I felt really uncomfortable around other kids in school, and they all seemed to know how to get along with each other, and they knew how to play games and talk to each other, and I didn't. And so it by junior high school, I was keeping a bottle in my locker in school. I liked Bacardi 151. It was quick and easy. You didn't have to spend a lot of time drinking between classes. And I went through most of my high school, pretty much all of my junior high and high school, with a buzz of some kind going on. My story also includes drugs. I'm not going to try and code it for, you know, secrecy and call it other substances or outside issues. It was methamphetamine and cocaine and marijuana, and I used as much of all of the above as I could whenever it was available. I am dually addicted, so that is a serious part of my story. But I'm not going to dwell on it, mainly because my story isn't so much about what I drank or used or what I did, but what I felt. And I ended up sent to AA meetings because I got two drunk drivings in my senior year, or junior or senior year, high school. I was 17 or so, and going to meetings and going to the alcohol awareness classes, and I learned that people who drank like I drank and people who drank like I drank for the reasons I drank were alcoholics. So I would go to the meeting, get my court card signed, go rent a movie across the parking lot from it, and then, like, since I didn't have a driver's license, the girlfriend at the time would drive me back to either her house or my house, or when I got thrown out the place I was renting, and I'd get drunk and beat her. And I would do these things because I was an alcoholic. And when I'd go to parties and my friends who drank like I did would stand there and bogart the keg, and people would give us lip about it, we'd tell them, we're alcoholics, we're doing our job, shut up. And I became, rather than a tool of recovery, just an excuse for my behavior. And I managed to avoid a DUI for roughly 7 years, but I was 24 years old, had just gotten thrown out of the Navy behind my behavior. Didn't actually include drinking until after I was thrown out, but I was not compatible with the military the way I thought and acted. Go figure. Got back to town, big party, and got my third DUI, and they sentenced me to a year in county jail. And so I hit county jail behind my drinking and came to the bright decision that what we ought to do with Super Bowl Sunday coming up is make some pruno. So my sobriety date of January 29th is actually Super Bowl. We drank our pruno on Super Bowl. That was my last drink, and I got lit enough to get good and belligerent and start a fight over a cigarette with a fellow. And when I looked at myself in the mirror in the infirmary, all busted nose, raccoon eye, beaten up, I had my first moment of clarity. I realized that I was now in an even smaller little jail, behind drinking, in the jail that I was in, behind drinking. And not only was alcoholism my excuse for my behavior, but it was a problem. And I could admit that this was a problem in my life. And I'd been attending H&I meetings from the moment I got to jail, because, you know, the jailhouse lawyers said you go to those and you tell the judge how good you're doing and you'll get out early. So I'd already been going, and after when I got out of the infirmary and was back in the fishbowl in Fresno, the main jail now. So I was out at a work farm when I got drunk. I had all the freedom in the world, so I threw that away, because that's what alcoholics do, right? So I started attending the H&I there, and there was a fellow that talked about getting sober that he looked at himself in the mirror the day after, and he would just the shame and the remorse and the guilt behind what he had done, and looking in the mirror at that lousy SOB looking back at him, he'd swear he didn't ever want to do that again, and he'd do anything not to have to do that again, and he'd know that that night he was going to do it again. And he felt utterly defeated and unable to do anything about the situation, and ashamed at the look in his wife's eyes. And I had already tried to commit suicide several times. It started out trying to get other people to shoot me. And at that not working, then I tried to overdose, drove myself up into the mountains and tried to overdose, and came to a fellow trying to get me to move my car off the road because I was blocking it. I just wanted to die rather than live like I was living, rather than to continue doing the things that I was doing. It seemed like a better idea to die than to live like I was, and I didn't know there was any other way. And the fellow in H&I talking about that, the guy he was looking at in the mirror, made absolute sense to me. I understood what he meant, and in my case it wasn't the wife, but it was the my mother, school teachers, and my girlfriend, the look in their eye over what I had done, and knowing that I had no choice in the matter. And that made sense to me, and I believed that if he could get sober, I could get sober. I quit looking at the differences. I quit looking at all the things. Because, again, I'm 24 years old at this time. I had lived in my parents' house and then in a little apartment, okay, a converted garage on the alley that I had rented. And I had gone to high school, and I'd taken a part-time job and gone to college and got kicked out of college, taken a full-time job. I'd never, you know, the only vehicles I did own a motor. I owned a 200cc motorcycle, 250cc motorcycle, and that I wrecked and wasn't able to ride in anymore, fine drinking. But I was still like borrowing my parents' car. There were none of these things that people talked about losing when they talked about careers that they had lost and marriages and houses. I didn't get those. But when the guy talked about losing the respect in his wife's eyes, losing the respect for himself that he saw in the mirror, I understood that loss. It wasn't a matter of the material items that I had thrown away behind this, that I'd given away, but it was the feelings that I had behind it, the utter pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that the book talks about. Shame, guilt, remorse, fear, anguish, all those things were the ones that I knew and I could relate to. And so I kept going to the H&I meetings. I did send my little letter off to the judge and ask, you know, can you please let me out early because I'm such a nice boy. And and I got a big book from the H&I group, and I started reading through it because jail provides a lot of time for that. I'm a good alcoholic, though, he said. Read the first 164 pages for the program of recovery. So I immediately went to the second part of it where there were stories. But in reading those, and today when I sponsor somebody new, I tell them we're going to start with the first 164 pages. And But the truth is, you know, those stories in the back of the book are really, really important. Those are the things where I read about people feeling like I was feeling and thinking like I thought and suffering the consequences that I did without having meetings to go to. So sitting in that jail cell, it was really, really important. I got one H&I meeting a week, but I got a lot of H&I meetings reading this section out of the big book. It meant a lot to me, and I could really relate to what I was reading in it when I was looking for the things that were similar. But I then turned back to the first 164 pages, and I got to the third step prayer. And in that jail cell, on my knees, I read the third step prayer to basically the God that the fellow that brought the H&I meetings in talked about. No real concept of my own. And within a couple of weeks of that, I got called to go visit the judge. That he got my letter. And he told me that the letter, you know, the request for modification of my sentence, there's no way he was going to do anything like that. It's not the first one he'd seen. But it turns out my parents had forwarded him a letter that I got. I'd applied for the IRS before I got turned myself into jail. And they called me back for a second interview. And the judge was going to let me out of jail to go to the second interview because maybe I'd get a job and make something of myself. And I walked out of the jail the next day knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt that nobody gets released from jail for a job interview. And for the first time, I actually knew and believed in my heart that there was a power greater than myself that was looking out for me, that was willing to take care of me if I would let him. And I went that night, I walked out of the jail and I walked to the nearest bus stop where my best dealer was sitting at the bus stop going to pick up. I also learned that my higher power has a great sense of humor. You just got to be willing to laugh sometimes. And I bummed a cigarette, and I walked the rest of the way to my parents' house because I was afraid to get on any bus and run into anybody else that I knew because I didn't think I could say no again. And that night, I went to a meeting at Fresno's a lot. Well, we used to have the ODAC Club in Fresno, One Day at a Time Club, which is kind of like an Alano Club, only a lot smaller, a lot darker, a lot smokier, and really scary. And it was really a great place, we've got a lot of the meetings that formed out of the ODAC still around in Fresno. But I went there that night because it was right near my parents' house. And I came in, and it was filled with smoke, and there were people that I was terrified of sitting there. And when I sat down, they moved away from me. I thought I was a badass. Turned out they were afraid. They didn't know whether I was going to projectile vomit or have a seizure or knock the tables over. But I went to a meeting that night. And I have not found it necessary to drink or use since then. I have done absolutely everything wrong in this program, except I haven't drank or used one day at a time. That would be great if that meeting was the first of many, but in fact, for probably my first 6 months, that might have been one of four or five. I did go to meetings. I'm going to say somewhere around 6 months dry time, I went to a meeting and I went to a meeting and I met the fellow that brought H&I in, and I asked him to sponsor me. That's when I quit going to meetings, which so many of you that have asked for me to sponsor and then I never see you again, I do understand. It's exactly what I did. But I quit going, you know, I went to meetings occasionally, once a month or so if I was desperate. Hung out with the same people that I always did. Got involved in a relationship because, see, I was in a relationship when I got sober. So I thought since I broke up with her because she wouldn't get sober, that was the loophole in that don't get into a relationship for the first year. good alcoholic thinking. I picked a normie. Not a normie. Second date, where did you want to go? How about the bar? You know, I've done everything that you are not supposed to do. I really, really have. I don't recommend it to anybody. Hanging out with the old friends was really, really dangerous for me. Actually, the normie, not a normie that I was involved with, we went out to listen to music at a bar with my friends, and we got into an argument, and she stormed off, and so I was feeling sorry for myself. And hanging out in a bar with my old drinking and using friends, feeling sorry for myself, not a good place for a recovering alcoholic. And a friend of mine turns to me and says, man, I know you're trying not to drink these days, but that's a bummer. Why don't I buy you a light beer? And finally, the light went on. I am in the wrong place with the wrong people at the wrong time. What the hell am I doing if I'm trying to stay sober? And I went home that night, and I called my sponsor, and I met him over at a meeting where he went to meetings, which the really good meetings there, and we still have meetings in that same facility, not as many anymore, a fellow was sharing about what got him into recovery was when they repossessed his boat. And I went home and I called my sponsor and said, I'm not sure I understand what they're talking about there. So he directed me over to Fresno Fellowship in Fresno. And he went met me at Fresno Fellowship and introduced me to a few people, and I stayed for a meeting, and I found my higher power. There was this redhead sitting in the back of the room that was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. And that kept me going to that meeting for about 6 months. Never said a word to her, never got the courage to say anything. And as a matter of fact, she did not remain sober, and she died behind this disease. But at least it got my happy ass there. I stayed around for her, and I found a higher power that I could believe in the program. I heard a lot of people share from the heart what was really going on with them. And I met some people that rode motorcycles and had a club that they rode with in sobriety called the Fifth Chapter, and they invited me to come to some of their events. And I ended up becoming a patch holder with the Fifth Chapter Motorcycle Club, and which for about a year until they were closed, and then some other friends that I had met through them had their own club called Sierra Outriders Motorcycle Club, and I became a patch holder with that club, and over the course of the next few years ended up becoming the president of that club. And we carried the message to people who don't come in here to get the message. And it did some really, really good things for my sobriety. It taught me a lot about how to accept everyone and everything as it is, without judgment. It allowed me to see that this disease affects everyone, from the people who get boats repossessed to the people who scrape barnacles off of boats, and everything in between. And it afforded me the opportunity to meet alcoholics from all over the state and all walks of life, and to carry the message to others. Back to the steps of this program now. I hovered on that third step that I took in jail, probably till about a year and a half sober. I had gone in and out of the relationship with the normie, not a normie. We broke up, got together, broke up, kind of thing. white-knuckling my recovery, parroting what I heard in meetings from other people, finally ran out, and I was left. I'd lost the job. I got all the things back, and I drifted away again, is what it comes down to. And I lost the job, and I lost her, and I lost the apartment, and I was back to sitting on the floor of the apartment wanting to die again. Seriously considering suicide behind, it's not working for me. And another, one more time in my life, what I did is I did the real third step prayer. And I sat in the dark in that apartment that I was about to lose with nothing left in the place, really. And I said, "Help me, God, I can't do this anymore. I need you, and I can't go on like this." And turns out that the lady that lived downstairs worked in mental health, and she came by to, because she hadn't seen me in a few days. And she had her husband take me over to mental health, and got me treated for the depression I was going through, and got me back into meetings, and saved my ass. And I went to a speaker meeting, and heard this old biker speaking in Madeira. And after the meeting, I was told, you go up and you shake the speaker's hand afterwards. And so I go up to shake his hand, and he looks me in the eyes. He's got these steel blue eyes that just look right through you. And I could tell that he'd been places that I'd been and done things that I had done. And he looked at me and he just says, "You could be a lot happier than you are today. Why don't you get my number and give me a call?" And so I called him, and he became my sponsor. And he said, part of the reason it's not working for you is you're not working it. And so we need to get you on steps, and we need to get you on a fourth step. So I, he says, "Get your big book out and read it, and we'll do a fourth step." So I went to a fourth step workshop and filled out a form that they had there, and I took it back to him, and he said, "You must have misunderstood me." I said, "Get your big book out and read the fourth step and work on it." And so I went to listen to a speaker tape, the Joe and Charlie speaker tapes on the fourth step, and filled out the little form that they had at that meeting thing. And I went back to him, and he looked it over and said, "We'll save this. This might work for part of your fifth step. Now, do you own a big book?" He had me get my big book out and go over the fourth step as it's laid out in the big book. First thing he had me do is right at the top of the page, "Keep it simple, stupid. Quit complicating it. Quit looking for the shortcut. Quit looking for a way out. Do it like it says." And we went through and we did a fourth step. And afterwards, we immediately took care of a fifth step. And I shared, those secrets that I was never going to tell anybody. And he smiled. So let me tell you some of the things I've done. And he told me about some of the things that he never would tell anybody. He also told me that there's absolutely nothing I have done that he didn't think about doing, or would have done under the same circumstances. And if he took if I went to a large meeting and talked to everybody about it, everything I did, somebody there has done, would have done, or thought about doing. We're not unique. We're not different. We're not special. We're just alcoholics. We have a head that tells us that nobody has ever felt like this before. I got a friend who is a normie, and he talks about stuff, and he goes, "I'm sure everybody's felt like this," but it's like, that's why he's a normie. He assumes everybody has felt like he feels. I assume no one has ever suffered like this before. That's the major difference between us. I went through and I made my amends to people. I have still people on the amends list. There are a lot of people out there, a lot of things I did that there's no statute of limitations on. If these people, you know, he sat down with me and he says, we're going to make up a couple different lists here. We're going to do the amends that you're going to do. We're going to do the amends that, that really aren't your part in this. You may have had something wrong, but you need to understand that this is part of life sometimes. That one, and by the way, for anyone who's new, don't think you get off easy. That was a very, very short list. But we also made a list of the amends that I am not going to go see these people and put myself in harm's way. I don't do anybody any good dead. Or in prison. But they come walking through the doors of a meeting, I get to walk up to them and say, hey, we need to talk. And it has happened in sobriety. In just the last couple of years, there's been a fellow that came from the old world, and I got to sit down with him and I got to make amends. The life that I came from, we talk a lot about, you know, I got life back in the program, and I didn't. My life that I had, what it could have been maybe, nothing compared to what my life has become, what my life in sobriety is. If I made a list of the things that I thought my life was going to be by getting sober, I would have sold myself so short. I went on to have a career, to get a college degree, to have a career, to be respected by my peers in the industry, to be one of the kind of, you know, we're alcoholics, right? We have to work twice as hard because we know we're going to screw up, right? So, I got to become the guy that gets sent places to solve problems that other people don't. Because they could trust me. I got a boss that, you know, flat told me, you know, I've got two of you that, yeah, I can't count on you guys to show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, not to save my life, but if we've got something that needs to get done and there's no one else I can count on to do it, one of you guys is going. And I don't lose a bit of sleep over it. You'll get the job done. And that was not me. That was not me growing up. But, I got to cut the umbilical cord of my daughter when she was born, and I got to go through losing her in sobriety, and probably will never see her again. Might be God's will that we get, you know, she comes seeking me, but it might not. I've been married a couple of times, and I'm working on a second divorce. I've seen some beautiful, magical moments in my recovery, and I've suffered some tragic losses, but I go through all of them one day at a time without drinking and using. I'd love to have a funny story or something, but, you know, life is just life on life's terms. It's not always going to be great, and it's not always going to be bad. The beauty of it is clean and sober, I get to go through it, every bit of it. I get to experience it all and learn from it all. I get to make great friends. Just an aside, I was never the kind of guy, until the last few years, I've always been the guy that drifts over to different meetings and different places. Never was committed to a home group for very long at a time. And so last night, there were some guys got together, sent out an email, hey, let's go for a ride. There's a meeting up in Pine Flat. And it's like, wow, I didn't know they had a meeting in Pine Flat. Didn't know they even had a Legion Hall in Pine Flat, for that matter. But so we hopped on the bike and we rode up there, and I walked through the door, and there are two people there that I know well. I've gone to places, I went to the International Convention in 2010, and hadn't even gone inside the register yet before I ran into people that I'd known. From not from around here, but know him, see him at least once a year. When the book says, you know, you'll surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny, we are all over the place. And it is just a miracle to know that no matter where I am or whatever I'm doing, at any moment I'm able to look up and see a face that I recognize and know that I am not alone in what I'm going through. That there is always some of us from the program within reach. There will always be somebody when I'm feeling like nobody knows how I feel that I can look at and talk to, and they'll shake their head and go, yeah, I know what you mean. I can get through absolutely anything. With this, somebody was sharing just before this meeting about wanting to share a great event that they'd had, one of their successes, and there was nobody there. And it's like, well, they weren't turning to alcoholics. If they'd have picked up the phone to call an alcoholic and tell them about it, we'd have been there. There's always somebody there to share my successes with. There's always somebody there to share my pain with. There's always somebody there that'll tell me it's okay today. And one day at a time, you can get through anything. You can learn from this. And I am truly, truly grateful to a God that, quite honestly, I don't understand. But I am fully convinced He made me exactly the way I am. And this is what I'm supposed to be doing today. And, you know, that's wonderful to know when I'm doing something great like this. But when I'm having one of those moments, when I'm in fear, when I'm sad, and I can think for a moment and know that I'm exactly where God wants me right this minute, it's going to be okay. Nothing is going to happen that I can't walk through with His help. And it makes anything possible. And see, normally I run out of time before I run out of... quite frankly, before I get out of the fourth step. Now I'm out of story and I've got time left. Absolutely, though.
Does anybody have any questions you'd like to ask?
Something like, why in the heck did they have you come up here?
Don't get that before.
There you go. There's fun. When I joined that motorcycle club, fifth chapter, part of being in a motorcycle club is having a road name. And I had the normie who turned out not to be a normie that I was involved with, broke up with. I started going to Codependence Anonymous in addition to AA. And so when they gave me a road name with the fifth chapter, they said, you're going to be caretaker. That's going to remind you of exactly where you came from, and you don't have to do that anymore.
What's on your t-shirt?
Akipa! Fresno. Yeah, we don't have... I was thinking I was going to run into some of my Fresno County young people.
Hmm? Young people
who come out from the story. Last year, one of those wonderful minutes, thank you very much, that I have gotten to enjoy in my recovery. Last year in Fresno, I got involved with Fresno County Young People's. Actually, I got involved the year before, but they won ACCI, the All-County Young People's AA event for Fresno. And so I became member at large for the ACCI and got to experience my, the year that I got sober, it was the last time ACCI was in Fresno. And I wasn't there. I was way too spun, or else I was chasing the redhead. But last year, I got to attend ACCI in Fresno and be a part of it, help put it on, and serve my fellow alcoholics by helping them have a great time and fun in sobriety. And I'm still a part of ACCI. And down this way you have Tookie Paw, and I strongly recommend you get involved. Young people's AA, like you say, when I got here, I didn't understand the losses they were talking about. There was no career to lose or whatever, but I did understand this loss of self and the suffering that I went through. And in young people, had we had it then, I would have been able to find people who understand what that suffering inside is like, and being young and feeling even misunderstood in a group of people whose story is all about being misunderstood. So I strongly recommend young people, and you do have it down here with Tookie Paw. But it has been my pleasure and honor in the last couple of years of my sobriety to be heavily involved in the young people's and help carry this message to people who might otherwise be like I was, sitting in that meeting at 17, 18 years old and feeling like they didn't get it and I don't understand. So, but thank you, Greg. Okay. I am going to quit now while I am ahead. Thank you all for being here.